Accession number 12049, Reel 2.
Mr. Meninsky, Reel 2.
And there were thousands of troops milling about, including a lot of our own fellows, because they quickly formed us into our own regiments. So what we thought was an empty island, we suddenly realised that it was not an empty island at all. And I suppose at the time one was under such a strain, because I can remember a comment passed by a sergeant who had stayed when the others went, a man called Butterfield, who was not only a regular soldier but had fought through the Spanish War and was a highly intelligent and sensitive individual. And I remember him saying, as we surrendered, there we are now, we've finished one battle and we're about to start another. And I looked at him, I thought, what do you mean start another battle, for goodness sake, the battle's finished. And I asked him, I said, what do you mean by that? He said, well, we're now, our new enemy is going to be hunger and disease and monotony. And I've never forgotten those words. Sadly, he died in the camps, Butterfield. He was a very good friend of mine. And something else which also happened at the time, which I think I should mention, is shortly after we surrendered, before we went, marched into Singapore to form up, only to march back to Changi, of course, we were handing in our rifles and weapons, and we had seen the first Japanese. They'd come along the road on bicycles. And they didn't interfere with us, but one of them grabbed hold of a Chinese woman and obviously was going to rape her. And to our amazement, a Japanese officer appeared on a bicycle and he just pulled out a revolver and shot him through the head. Complete summary justice. I mean, he didn't ask any questions. He just shot him through the head.
Where was this?
This was just near Thompson Village. Before we'd gone into Singapore, only to come back, of course, to Changi. And I can remember thinking at the time, my God, if they do that to their own people, what are they going to do to us?
Do you think your comrades were pleased about it?
They were very shaken. I mean, they could see the justice in stopping the man completing the rape, but to just shoot him through the head without question, I think we were all shocked a bit. I have no doubt about that.
Could I just go back to the desertions from your unit's position? Do you think that the removal of those officers for evacuation had demoralised the troops?
I'm pretty sure it had.
Did they make comments on it?
Yes. They were told that they were taken away because they had specialist knowledge, which they wanted to retain, which of course made sense. But I think the fellows decided that it went beyond that, that it was the beginning of an evacuation, and if there was going to be one, they were going to be part of it. I don't think they could see any point in holding on, only to surrender. I mean, whether that had actually gone through their minds or not, I don't know. I don't know why it didn't, but it didn't occur to me to do that. I mean, it just didn't. I'm fairly sure. Well, let's put it this way. I had a group of chaps in the platoon that were totally under my command, and I was very friendly with them all. And I've always been convinced that my greater fear, and let's face it, anyone that's not afraid in action is a fool, but my fear of showing my fear to the fellows that trusted me was stronger than my fear of what was happening. Do you understand that?
Yes.
Because those fellows stayed with me to the man. We were never separated.
Did you inflict a large number of casualties on the Japanese at that road?
Quite a lot, yes. Quite a lot.
With automatic fire?
With Bren guns, mostly. And with a 2-inch mortar, we killed a number. But we killed quite a lot with Bren gun fire.
Could you see them running across the road?
Yes, we could. We could.
In daylight or at night?
In daylight, yes. There was a small bridge nearby, and they tried to cross the bridge, and we stopped them. and we killed a lot. They took their wounded away, incidentally, so we weren't able to count them, but we killed quite a lot, yeah.
How did the Japanese carry out their attack?
They just suddenly appeared. I mean, they had this extraordinary ability to get very close to you, which was probably because they were accustomed to jungle warfare. Now, we weren't in jungle, we were in rubber plantation. And they could get extremely... And suddenly, at a given signal, I presume, they would suddenly rise up and come straight at you. I mean, they seemed to have no fear at all. They just ran at you with fixed bayonets.
Quietly or noisily?
Very noisily, shouting at the tops of their voices. I mean, part of their method was to make as much noise as possible. I mean, they were screaming and shouting. They also, incidentally, used a lot of fireworks. I don't know whether you know this, but they threw crackers, which were quite devastating. They went off with a terrific bang, and you never quite knew whether it was a grenade or a cracker. I suppose it was cheaper to use firecrackers and throw an awful lot of grenades. So they made a hell of a row, actually.
Was that patrol that you described the only patrol that was carried out from your positions?
Which?
The patrol that you led.
It was at that particular time. We had earlier had patrols. In fact, when we were... wait a minute, I've got to get this. The previous evening, prior to the actual evacuation of the officers, we'd sent out a patrol, and they were due to come back at whatever hours, 0700 or whatever, and due to come back in a certain direction. And in actual fact, they didn't come back when they should have done, and when they did come back, they came back from in a totally opposite direction to where they should have come from. And I'm sorry to say that our chaps in the frontline weapon pits opened fire on them and killed a couple of them. It's one of those things. I mean, I think this happens in war far more than is normally talked about. But A, they were an hour late, and B, they came back in the wrong direction. Now, the following morning, a patrol of Gurkhas went out to see if they could find any Japanese. This was from Thompson Village, and this was again prior to the... we must have been there about 5 days, I suppose, in all, before the actual evacuation. The Gurkhas went out, and we were told what time they were going out, direction they were going in, and when they would be back. And I remember this very vividly because it really shook me. We waited for them to come back, and they didn't come back. So we gave them an extra quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, and then reported back to HQ, battalion HQ, that the patrol hadn't returned, only to discover that they had returned absolutely on time, and they'd come right through our lines, and we hadn't seen them. They were fantastic, the Gurkhas. They'd actually come right through our lines in broad daylight and we hadn't seen them. And they brought quite a lot of information. Part of the information, I would imagine, was the fact that they were preparing to attack in that area because it was that night that the officers were evacuated.
Where were the Gurkhas situated? Was there a line?
No. They were situated about half a mile behind us. There was our battalion headquarters. There was also a group of Northumberland Fusiliers who were using 3-inch mortars. And behind them there was some artillery. And there was a group of Gurkhas, I don't know how many, were at that time working at our battalion headquarters. I mean, but we were making use of them, obviously, for reconnaissance. They had been evacuated from the mainland, and I suppose they'd been dispersed amongst various units for that particular purpose, because they were absolutely amazing. I mean, we had no no idea that they'd come back. We saw them go out, but with no idea they'd come back. And they had a terrible habit of... I talked to some of them, I had sat with them and had a sandwich. And they have this terrible habit of collecting ears. I don't know if you know about them. And when they kill someone, they try and take an ear. And I was sitting eating whatever, I can't remember even what it was now. And this fellow was very proud. He opened a mess tin and he got about 5 ears in this mess tin, which he'd had there for goodness knows how long, because the smell was unbelievable. And I can remember I didn't eat any more, or whatever it was I was eating. It was rather unpleasant. But they were amazing people, the Gurkhas.
You described your admiration for the qualities, soldierly qualities of the Japanese troops, but when you discovered the bayoneting and so on, did you and your comrades hate the Japanese?
Yes, we did. I mean, it also increased one's fear, because your thought was, well, is that what they're going to do to all of us? It wasn't so much a hatred as a fear, I suppose. I don't know whether you can separate them. In actual fact, of course, it transpired to be totally different. The Japanese soldiers that took us over at the surrender were anything but vicious. I mean, they tended to be the other way round. I mean, I was absolutely amazed. I mean, if they got an opportunity, they would... And they gave you a rest, they would sit down and they would bring out photographs of their wives and children and show you this without any knowledge of English, or very few of them had any English. They would show you photographs, but it was obvious from the sign language that they were telling you this was their wife and this was their child, and they were asking you, did you have any similar photograph? One got a totally different feel about them very quickly, because our initial guards, I imagine, were front-line troops who were replaced by second-line troops. And they couldn't have been nicer. Now, that may have only applied in the area where I was. I mean, whether there were atrocities committed elsewhere, I have no way of knowing. But certainly the Japs that were in charge of our unit and took us back, and eventually we worked with, were very kind indeed. I'd be unfair to sort of say anything else.
Can you tell me where and when you were actually taken over by Japanese troops first of all?
Yes, they first of all took us over at Thompson Village, but there was only a very small number of them, and they instructed us to march into Singapore, which wasn't difficult to do, because the road that was in front of us was a direct road into Singapore. And once we got into Singapore, or onto the outskirts of Singapore, there were a lot of Japanese, of course, transport, bicycles, motorcycles, and they were quickly rounding us up and getting us into units. But whatever discussions had transpired with the what senior officers were left, it very quickly became obvious that we were still going to be under our own discipline. As you know, that remained throughout our prison camp life, because our own officers, those officers that were still there, were forming us up into units very quickly. The Japs were standing in the background, but they didn't do any appear to do any organising at all. It was done through our own officers and NCOs. In fact, the Japs insisted that all NCOs retained their rank and acted as NCOs. So if you were a sergeant or a corporal or whatever, you were still given the job of organising your small group of men.
You should say you were a corporal at the time.
I was a corporal, yeah.
What was the attitude of the Singaporeans towards you as you were captured?
We didn't see much of them. They'd all virtually gone underground. They'd all gone in and closed their shutters. The Chinese that one saw were sympathetic, but everybody else ignored you totally. They didn't speak to you. totally ignored you. One of the things that was very impressive was immediately after the surrender, almost every house had produced a Japanese flag which was hanging out the window. Whether the Japs had distributed them or not, I don't know, but there were thousands of these flags hanging out of the window. I can see the reason for that, self-preservation, I imagine. Also, of course, they may well have thought that they would have fared better under Japanese rule than they would under ours. I mean, I don't know. I have no idea about that. But certainly they ignored us totally, except for the Chinese, who were always, under all circumstances, very good to us.
Were the Chinese able to do anything for
us? Well, they gave us a certain amount of food. They gave us water, which is a very important commodity in that part of the world. They filled up our water bottles. Some of them gave us packets of biscuits, cigarettes. Sometimes, to the annoyance of the Japanese, although I didn't see many incidents where the Japanese were unkind to them either at that stage. I did later, but not at that stage.
Did you come across any hostility from any Singaporean civilians?
None whatsoever, no.
Where did the Japanese have you taken to?
Well, they then took us to Changi, not to the prison, but to the barracks at Changi. There were superb barracks there, and my own battalion didn't go into the barracks, oddly enough. We went under canvas, and we were the first. Just as you went into Changi, in the main gate, there was a row of shops. In fact, you have a drawing in the War Museum that I did of that row of shops. It became our battalion headquarters. So it was about five shops. It became a medical room, and one of the shops, and the other one was a battalion office. And we actually put up tents, and we were under canvas. And so as you came into the camp, then the first people you met on your right-hand side, behind the row of shops, was the 5th Battalion, Bedsman Hart. We built a camp, and we had to dig latrines, of course. And we had to build a cookhouse to cook the rice in. And we were there for, I was there anyway, for about 6 or 7 weeks while the camp was being built. And very quickly we established routines. I mean, we still, at the beginning, I still took PT classes because there wasn't a great deal to do and it was necessary to keep people in some sort of physical state. We quickly realised we weren't going to get a lot to eat because we got very meagre rations, and we organised a number of classes. I mean, there was somebody there who spoke French, and he had a small French class and so on, and that was something I'd like to talk about, actually, because it didn't take us very long to develop a sort of microcosm of the society we'd left behind. This went on all the way throughout our prison camp life. There was, if I can get a sort of percentage on this, there was a very small percentage of men that became quickly involved in black market in one form or another. In other words, they had the courage to slip out of the camp and trade. They would trade with watches, rings, and things of that nature. And they would bring back money and food and eventually medical supplies. Now, some of them became entrepreneurs, and they didn't go out themselves. They employed other people to do it, and they became known, I believe, as King Rats. And throughout our prison life, these people existed, and they were a very essential part of our well-being because they not only brought back money, which was extremely useful, and they were very generous with it, but they also managed to bring back a certain amount of medical supplies. Crude they may have been, but they bring things back like iodoform and the magnet of potash and so on. So you had a small element of those, and then you had an element of men who were creative. In the camp at Changi, we had Ronald Searle, we had George Old, we had Jack Chalker, and Bob Brazil, and myself, all artists. And there were a number of people. There was a man called Leo Britt, who had been a radio producer, and he quickly got together a number of either professional or amateur actors. And we put on, we started to develop a theatre. I mean, in Changi, they put on, apart from variety shows, they put on I Killed the Count and Dover Road. And people like myself worked on designing a bit of decor, which we made out of the most extraordinary things. And if you take it on a percentage basis, I suppose if you took the entrepreneurs and the shopkeepers, they were people who used a little initiative, and they discovered that if you roast rice and roast it long enough, you can then grind it down and make what is like coffee, if you put a bit of guala malacca sugar in it. They would go around selling cups of coffee for 5 cents. So they were sort of shopkeepers. There were those that rolled cigarettes out of the native tobacco, which they would sell. So you've got the shopkeeper, the entrepreneur, then you've got the creative individuals, like a small number of people like Ronald Searle and so on, who worked in the theatre, together with those people who had theatrical talents. I mean, we had Dennis East with us, the violinist. We had a very famous tenor with us, whose name I can never remember. So if you add the two together, you probably take about between 5 and 10% of the people that were there. Or there were also those people who had a very professional knowledge in a subject who would lecture at night. I can remember one man, for example, who was an expert on bees, and he gave a lecture that lasted for 2 evenings, and it was absolutely fascinating. Then you would have about another 10 or 15% of men who hadn't any particular talent in any of those directions, but were always willing to do the donkey work. So if you design something, they would build it, if you know what I mean. Amongst that section, you had, for example, some instrument makers who later made surgical instruments out of virtually nothing. So by now you've taken about probably 20% of the total who would be involved, directly involved, at one level or another. And then you had about another 60 to 70% who went to everything. I mean, they would go to every lecture there was, they'd go to every theatre show there was. This went on right throughout the 3.5 years. Didn't contribute anything, but became very good audiences, and many of them probably had never been to the theatre in their life before. I mean, but became interested. They would go to lectures on subjects I'm sure they would never have even considered thinking about. And there was about 10%, between 5 and 10%, who never participated in anything. They didn't help in any way, and nor did they go and listen, nor did they go and look. And the extraordinary thing about it was that they nearly all died. They just sort of curled up and died. But this attempt to almost recreate a sort of microcosm of one's own life started right at the beginning, and it went on right throughout the prison life, even under the worst circumstances. When we were up on the railway, we had a theatre in the camp.
Could I ask you about the King Rat phenomenon?
Yes.
Did you use that phrase whilst you were there, or is it something...
No, it's something which an expression I've heard since. In fact, I knew one of them extremely well, a marvellous character who had the lovely name of Virgo, who had been a senior civil servant. And only a matter of about 18 months ago, he got in touch with me, would you believe? He'd seen some of my paintings in somewhere, and he got in touch. And he was an extremely intelligent, clever man, and he was one of those people that didn't go and do it himself. He employed other people to do it. And when he came out of the prison camps, I'm sure he wouldn't mind me telling you this, he had made so much money that he would cash checks for people written on anything, you know. And when he came home, I met him about 2 or 3 years after we came home, and then I didn't see him again until recently. And he came home with about £15,000 worth of checks, where he'd said, give me a check for £100 and I'll give you so many Thai dollars. And every single cheque was honoured when he got home, which was quite extraordinary. But he made so much money, I mean, he couldn't spend it because we were very limited what we could buy. You could buy a few bananas, some peanut toffee, native tobacco, and a few eggs. I mean, there wasn't very much. A few bananas. But he was definitely an entrepreneur, but took no risks himself, you know.
But you felt that they were doing a good job.
Oh, absolutely, because they not only brought money in, which was circulated, they nearly all of them contributed money to the hospital to buy extras for the hospital. I didn't know one that didn't. But they also brought in drugs. By that I mean medical supplies rather than... I'm not talking about... Well, they did bring a certain amount of drugs because there was one occasion when I had pleurisy and the only thing they could give me to kill the pain, I had to sniff cocaine. So they must have brought in some of that sort of thing.
Did your fellow POWs also feel the same about their role?
Yes. And nobody... There was no envy of this. None whatsoever. I mean, this is something which I find extremely interesting. I don't know whether you remember, but there was a series on television not very long ago called Tenko,
yes,
which was about a woman's prison. And the thing that irritated me about that series, it was extremely well done, and the acting was good, and et cetera, et cetera. But the women were always quarrelling. I don't know if you remember that. I can count on one hand the number of times I saw a quarrel in 3.5 years. It just didn't happen.
Why do you think it was?
It seemed almost... The only thing I can think of is... I mean, I've described to you the manner in which this effort was made to sort of rebuild a society you knew and understood, although in a crude form, obviously. But also, I think, people learned the necessity to look after each other and be kind to each other. I mean, the amount of kindness I saw in the camps was absolutely extraordinary. I mean, all right, I do remember seeing a fight in River Valley Road when one of the things that the Australians used to do, they used to have frog races. They used to, because the Australians are terrible gamblers, and they would line up some frogs and they would have a starting point, and you bet on the frog which got to the furthest point, which was the finishing line. And there was one frog which absolutely outstripped everybody else, and suddenly one night somebody picked this frog up and turned it over, and what this Australian had done, he'd sawn off two ends of two pins and put in this poor beast's back feet, so every time it landed the pins went in a bit further. And it just jumped very quickly. And the fellow that picked the frog up was so angry, he walked over and he hit him very hard and on a number of occasions. That was one of the few occasions I ever saw a fight. It just didn't happen. And you would hear the odd argument on a subject, but I mean, this is what shocked me about Tenko. People weren't like this. Totally the other way around. I mean, once we got into the real...